Hello, I'm here today to do a podcast report on the school experiment called the Maltese Cross. You'll probably remember it as someone with a little DC power supply setting up a high voltage source, which is usually a self-induction coil, and it will typically go buzz, and little sparks will fly, and then you hook this high voltage source up, and more will be described later, to a tear-shaped tube. It will glow, and a little Maltese cross will appear in shadow form on the base of the tear, the base screen of the tear, and magnets will be used to get that shadow to dance around the place as you deflect the electrons produced as they fly from their source of origin through the glass tube to hit the far wall. This is Peter Hill Explains, where I discuss things scientific. I'm here to try and accelerate and basically improve my rate of podcasting, but also this is one area where I have yet to read one correct explanation of what is going on here in the literature, and furthermore, I've yet to hear one, I suppose, fellow teacher give a correct explanation. And when you actually build the apparatus and take them there, they will look the other way. It's amazing. You ask them to look at it, but they're so wed to their textbook drawing of what's going on that they will actually physically look the other way. In this one, we're going to actually not look the other way and take a deep look at this, but in audio space. So I have to paint a picture for you. So to get ourselves into the mood, we're in the 30 years between 1869 and 1899. Horse and buggy time. The old telegraph and air flight has not come about, and physicists or scientists are all men, and a lot of them in England, and they're going around and they're beginning to play with these glass tubes, hooking them up to high voltage. They can now reliably get these unusual discharges, produce X-rays, and along the way, eventually, by the end of this 30-year period, definitively discover a new particle called the electron. So before this, there was no such thing as an electron. It was a mystery of what was going on. So they produced this. Now, the general idea of a evacuated tube, it's not a vacuum as we would call it. It's 10 to the minus 6 torr. I suppose millibar would be pretty much the same thing. Very small fraction of atmosphere, or let me see, 760, a torr is a millimetre of mercury. There's 760 millimetres of mercury in an atmosphere. So 10 to the minus 6 is a billionth of an atmosphere. And the way that they're able to do this is they'd get a, I believe they get a tube, fill it with the mercury, upend it, and the mercury pull down, and then there's a sort of another a mechanical device which actually got that mercury vapor and pulled it down. So the mercury, which is a liquid metal, could flow in, displace the air inside your glass tube, pull down, and I think there's yet another pump, and this was able to get you to these new pressures. And I'll just describe, you've got basically a glass tube, and this is produced by starting off with a cylinder of glass, sealing the end, and blowing into it, and you blow into it. In these days, with your mouth, there's a bit like blowing a didgeridoo. You have a way of with your mouth maintaining constant pressure, and as you heated it up, you rotated it and spun it, and you could spin this into a bottle. But rather than a bottle, you'd seal it at the other end. The way that you seal things is that you heat up, stop blowing, keep on twisting, and your tube twists down to a it closes down, heat it up, and you seal it off. And of course, this time you wouldn't, you're obviously, in this case, providing positive pressure with your air pressure of your breath inside. But in this case, you're building basically a bottle. But this is a tear-shaped bottle with a base and a top. And onto the side of this, you put an arm. And in this arm is a glass tube. And this glass tube is hooked up to a vacuum pump. And so this sucks out the air. You may heat up the glass to get the air and rubbish out of it, or wash it out first with an acid rinse, and then pour it out. So you have basically a glass bottle with basically what we probably recognise as a bong, unfortunately. It's it's half or a third of the way along. It is a tube coming out, and this tube is where the air is pulled out, and once you've got the pump going, you light up your gas torch, spin it around, and as you twist around, you will lock it off and create a permanent vacuum tube, a Crookes tube. Now, of course, there's another link here, is you've got to get electrodes into it. So basically, you can get something called a frit, prepared metal, treat the metal, I think, with an acid, attach the frit to it, heat the frit onto it, and the frit will form basically an enamel. So an enamel is a glass bonded with metal, and you can use this glass and then close your glass tube around this glass so it goes down and forms your electrical feed-throughs. So the very first version of this is called a Crookes tube. So Crookes is the person who got the low enough pressure, and his electrode was an electrode of choice. So it's an electrode a bit like a brass button. The person would machine, but was made out of brass, not aluminium there. They hadn't discovered aluminium. And they'd machine the brass in a throat lozenge, and actually connect that through to your electrical feed through. So I would assume, I don't know exactly how this was done. I don't know what the actual material, the feed through material is. I doubt that you could form a frit onto to brass. It just doesn't quite make sense to me. But so that's your electrode. And so the first Crookes tube, it's a fairly simple thing. It starts like a sausage. It starts with a electrode, goes for a while. It's got a side a tube for removing atmosphere, and then another electrode tube. So you basically discharge along it, and having a great enough dark space, electrons go off the surface, and it's only until they reach a certain energy do they actually hit a gas particle, and there are gas particles there. So until they reach this energy, they go up. Now, once they do hit a gas particle, you get metastable or excited particles, and you get a front, the gas particles stop. You get a shockwave, a striation. So up to this, you've got something called a dark space, called a Crookes dark space. And above, when it finally goes along the tube, long enough, it will hit the residual gas and form a striation pattern. I think it might be even called the Faraday dark space. I think it's the Crookes dark space. And these striations are successive shockwaves. Because they've got light and particles flowing through it, the distance to the next shockwave is sufficiently short, so you get a dark space, I think it's a Crookes dark space, and a series of closely spaced shockwaves. Now, if you get better and better and make smaller and smaller tubes, you can actually, the electrons will pass from one end to the other and not hit a gas particle. When it hits a gas particle, it expands massively in size, effective size, because it's injured, bruised, so to speak. So imagine you've got a small atom, you hit it, it expands its size, and then it's ready to be hit again. And this process creates unstable gas particles which go around, excite other gas particles, and you just get basically a road accident, a crash of gas particles. But if you have sufficiently low pressure, it goes, the electrons travel from the negative electrode all the way to the positive electrode. Now, the next development was someone called Hitov. Amazing. I only remember him because it's Hitov. I sort of like the idea of something to do with particles being called Hitov. But he observed that whatever's been produced at the negative electrode travels up and creates a fluorescence in the glass behind the positive electrode. That is, the electrons keep on going forward. Now, to actually investigate this a bit more, to make it bigger and so that you see it, you have this person called Plucker, like Plucker as well. Now, there's two stories here. There's a sort of a folk story I've been told, and the actual historical story of this Plucker. Now, Plucker is the person who makes the Maltese cross. So rather than a tube, he makes a bottle. In the bottle, he, at the top of the bottle where you have the screw cap, he seals that off with an electrode, a button electrode, and he has a positive electrode, not behind at the base of the bottle, but down the evacuation tube. Just a little, just happens to be a little piece of wire sticking in, and hooked. And on top of that, he has. Now, remember, although you have aluminium in your school one, aluminium hasn't been discovered yet. So I suppose it would have been brass or copper. And a copper obstacle. Now, this is designed, a mechanical thing, that you can tip the Maltese cross on upside down, such that the narrow end is facing downwards. The base or bottom of it, the big display end, is upwards. In this case, this little shelf, so to speak, will drop down, this metal shelf, and this is the Maltese cross obstacles. And then you can tip it around the other way, and it will flip forward, but it flips forward and remains tilted around about 10 degrees backwards, but such that it will then form an obstacle to form your cross, which will appear on the rear here. And this is where I think we have a sort of departure between how things are described at school. I think I remember a long time ago reading a Wikipedia article which just made me tear my hair out. So the general idea is that people observe that electrons emerge from your button on your button surface, perpendicular from your button surface. And this is, in fact, true. There is a small number of electrons which do emerge at 90 degrees to the surface, because your button is like a lozenge shape. And you look at it, you'll be able to see, when you've energized your Maltese cross, a small fluorescent ring around your button, as the surface of the button, which is curved, has a high emission field from it. So this is an important thing, that electricity moves off sharp objects. So you've got a disk, so there's a large flat area where electrons shouldn't come off. It's flat, there's no charge there, yet we have this ability that electrons are streaming from this flat surface. And again, that's incorrect. The you do have a curvature where this button, if you look on end on, is this circle, curved circle on the edge of it. So if you imagine a sucked throat lozenge. So if you suck it for a long time, it'll be flat, and you'll have that. If you feel it in your mouth, there's that sharp edge. From that sharp edge, electrons do emerge from it, and you can see this ring. This is the first thing that you have to observe. And astoundingly, when I pointed, students can see it, but I pointed out to other teachers, they cannot see that ring. Students can see this green ring. So this is at the shallow end of your Maltese cross. You've energized it up, and we'll discuss about energy. We'll stop here and discuss about how this is energized. And you will see this fluorescent green fluorescence. So when the electrons hit the, it really hit any disordered object like glass, it will fluoresce. It will fluoresce yellow if it's a sodium glass, a more bluey tinge if it's a what is it, a quartz glass, i.e. with a very low metal in it. So the metal, it will glow sodium yellow. And you'll see this ring, and it comes off that small radius of curvature. So the general observation that electrons emerge at 90 degrees from the surface is correct, but their emergence is not uniform. And this is the assumption you see in textbooks. You see electrons emerging as a wave uniformly from the surface, and we'll see that this is not true. Now let's talk about excitation. We've got 6 volts at the school laboratory power supply, and we have to convert that to 20,000, 40,000, 50,000 volts. Low energy, low current, such that we can't kill someone with it, but a voltage which nonetheless can create a spark, a glow. So in terms of a light, this is a 1 or 2 watt experiment that you will observe coming out. And it does indeed produce, we should tell you that it does produce a few tiny fraction of x-rays, nothing really to talk about. Now how this is done is that this 6 volts energizes an electromagnet. An electromagnet then pulls a little button, which then breaks the current. So what happens is that you have basically a relay which goes pop, 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 pop. So as the relay, as the electromagnet energizes, it pulls a small piece of metal away and breaks the circuit. And so if you imagine this is a basically a square wave generator for free. So you put in DC and you get a square wave generator for C for free. Now this means that you've got a magnetic flux produced here, and there's, I think it's Faraday's law of induction. If I have wires on the outside, so if I have say 100 coils on the inside and say 10,000 coils on the outside, my 6 volts can be multiplied by 6,000 because it's coil per coil if the induction loop is correct. So in the centre here you also have of this electromagnet you've got a laminated iron core. So that means that increases the magnetic field in there, and so you've got a magnetic field switching on and off, and the sudden edge of the magnetic field is measured. Now it's not a strict ratio because it's not a sine wave, it's a square wave, so you've got some fairly high frequencies in the to make up the Fourier of that square wave. That produces a high voltage pulse, and this high voltage pulse travels down your wires to your tube, and your tube goes on your negative electrode in the tube on the narrow end of your bottle, and you remember your bottle has a tier downwards to your positive electrode. Now these are side tubes which are basically cylinders which have been wound off, so heated and twisted. It's a bit like toffee. It's hot and toffee-like. So as you twist it, the twisting increases the size of the wall, and it twists and winds down, eventually until it closes off and forms a vacuum. So you have your positive electrode here. So you have a pulse, and it goes your negative electrode and your positive one. Now, this is where I think you need some observation, and rather than looking at the textbook, it's best to actually look at it. And this is what we're having. This is a podcast where the actual device is not here, but you're given a verbal look through. Now, if you turn off the light, you really have to turn off the lights here, you'll see an eerie blue glow of excited gas. So what happens is that this gas, a very low density gas, and it forms a particular shape, and the shape grows, and then grows from the negative electrode up in a cone, like a little finger. So in my view, I've got the electrode at the left, and this cone starts from the width of the bottle, the width of your Crookes tube, and goes down to a central point. It's an eerie blue glow, and then it looks around and bends as this ethereal glow and goes down to your positive electrode, which you've hooked it up to. And this has got a shape. The shape is actually dictated by the outside shape of the bottle. So as the bottle closes in, it keeps the shape away from it. Actually narrows right down to the centre. And so how does it have this shape? How has this produced? This is a positive glowing area, and I expect that it has positive ions which are produced, and these positive ions are making their way to the negative electrode. They're not electrons in there, because you'd see electrons, so electrons would leave and go. Electrons have a long mainframe path. This has got a short mainframe path. And so this is your positive electrons move, these positive ions, this is move along and actually create a, as they move along, create ionization breakdown, or not a high density plasma, but a very low density plasma. There's obviously some entrained electrons which move all the way down, low energy stuff. So a relatively low energy electron which accelerates up and interacts with the glass and makes this low pressure glass a conductive blue. It does glow blue, so we know that it is the residual gas which has been ionized in there, and this forms a virtual electrode, a gas electrode, which goes inside your Crookes tube. And this is the thing missing in all the textbook, is this virtual gas electrode. And this virtual gas electrode, it's not machined, but it is basically machined by the shape of the tube, comes down into the center of your button to a tiny little tip and sits just above it, a point above it. And you will, if you look, you're beautifully machined. I think people have aluminium, will have this burn mark where this gas tube will actually, this gas finger will hit. So if you go into your school lab and look at it, you'll see that these Maltese crosses have little black circular marks where this finger has gone down and actually touched it. And now, because this is conductive, it's got a low potential difference. And so you have a very short one, or less than a millimetre, I've looked at it, less than a millimetre acceleration space from the surface of your negative electrode on the left of your thing, towards the narrow end of your Crookes tube. This finger comes up, and there's this central point where the electrons emerge at high energy. Now, it must heat up, and there must be ion impact and exchange and all of the thing going on. It's very intense. And so this area heats up. It's essentially basically a spark, if you could do it. And this emits electrons. And we know from this area that your surface of electrons, and that surface is not a uniform surface. It's machined. It's a large, largish surface. But essentially, for almost from a point, and because we can tell actually the definition of the point surface, because if we have a flat, if you look at the sharpness of the shadow of our Maltese cross, and I'll do an aside of our Maltese cross, you can see the size and location of your source. And from this, we know that the electrons emerge in a cone from a point and expand out at angles, uniform. If it is painting the top part of the cross, it's from the same point at an angle. And we know something from this, that it's not necessarily the surface of your Maltese cross. And I would hazard to guess that if you were to incline your electrode at a few degrees, and perhaps it is inclined at a few degrees, electrons would not worry about this. They would actually look at the actual formation of your positive virtual gas electrode, acceleration electrode. And it's that smoothness of the electric field of that electrode which gives you the smoothness and beauty of the electron source. And the electron source is a point source rather than a flat wave-like source. Now, we'll have to go into it a bit more. So this travels through the tube. So, the tube at the, sort of, I suppose, a tenth of the way into the tube, you have your electrode. And two-thirds of the way into the tube, just before the wall, you have your, a third of the way, two-thirds, and a third, there you have your Maltese cross. The Maltese cross is a square of metal, but it's been cut with a the edges of the of the square cut in and further square, and it forms a cross not unlike the cross on the Swiss flag or the hospital flag. It's a hospital cross. It's actually not a Maltese cross. A Maltese cross tends to go in. And one of the stories I was told is that initially they said, oh, it's a German cross. And for political reasons, they didn't actually want to say, oh, look, we've made a German cross. They've called it a Maltese cross, simply because it was politically more expedient to do it. So you've got this cross or shadow. You could actually have a cutout nowadays, a laser cutout of a duck, and have a duck shadow cast. The important thing is that we've got a point source, and the point source is going out as a cone. And what happens is that you get a large picture on the other side. And so it's not unlike the campfire, where you've got your torch, and you're doing your hand shadows with a shadow puppet of a dog or a duck or a rabbit on the tent wall. Your hand is a certain size, but the shadow is a very much larger size. You know, in the comic books of a big shadow being cast, and people have been frightened of the big shadow, but really it's a small little cute thing going part of a source. So you get this magnification. And again, I've had it with teachers. I've said, look, what is the size of your Maltese cross? Oh, they will say, well, I estimate that is 3 centimetres across. And typically that's quite right. What is the size of your shadow? And for this, because of the geometry, it would be 5 centimetres across. So what does that mean? So does that mean that the shadow is magnified? It's a larger shadow. And students will say yes, but fellow teachers and other people who educate us will say no, it hasn't. So I've just more observed Maltese cross as an example of dogged determination that what's shown in the textbook will be what's shown there. And so if you actually see pictures on the internet of this, or videos on the internet, you'll be able to see it. You don't have to actually construct it here. But this is a seminal experiment. And so what we know is that electrons are produced and they travel in straight lines from a point. Now, there was a complexity that people, even back then, didn't say, oh, look, electrons are producing from a point. It's a bit very hard to have a wave source, but I have a point source of waves, which is more my mouth. The sound comes from my mouth and spreads over an angle, and so that's what's happening here. But people believed it was more like a gong. It would hit and this sound wave would come out flat. So for some reason this has existed, but the experimental evidence that it comes from a small point and it goes forward. I'll discuss the actual fluorescence of the glass. So the area not hit by the glass, hit the area kept in shadow, will not fluoresce. The area not in shadow will fluoresce, and fluoresce means that the electron impacts the glass. Now, glass is not a crystalline solid, and so therefore it doesn't conduct electrons. And so when you hit it with an electron, the actual electron structure inside adjusts. So these electrons can't travel anywhere. They move up, and the electrons, or free electrons, or electrons associated with the ions, exist in a complex void in amongst the silicon dioxide. I call it my void on theory of glass. I'll discuss it later. But in general, anything which is disordered, and electrons can't flow in it too easily, will fluoresce in this manner. And the electrons will settle down and lose energy, namely through the fluorescence of this sodium in glass. So the sodium in glass will form a complex and will glow this particular way. And as this process goes, the glass subtly UV hardens, that is, these voids. And you can't see it, but they just rearrange themselves a tiny bit. So if you can imagine these holes in glass, and you can see how they're connected by just moving the atoms a tiny little bit, you'll break these voids out. So initially, when you first have your first out-of-the-box Maltese cross, it will glow very strongly. But over the years, the UV damage to the glass will photon harden the glass, and your glass will dim down. And now, I'm only saying this because we're going to stop and talk about magnets in a short while, and talk about, I think it's Leonard, who then brought back the wave theory of what's going on. So the glass, which has not been photon hardened through this voidon area. Now, this voidon area is not a universally understood theory. It's sort of a locally produced theory up here in Australia, in photonics optical fibres that we worked on to explain optical phenomena and optical fibres. So this UV hardening, what you could do is you could heat the glass up, and this would reset what's it called, anneal the structures. So the glass, if through all these X-ray and neutron studies, the actual voids don't change all that much with UV hardening. However, they must do, because the amount of glowing they do with these UV or electrons reduce. Now, what you can then do is then heat it up, or you can just drop your Maltese cross down. And the Maltese cross is not made out of magnetic material, so you have to lift it up carefully. It's not hooked up. Lift it up, tip it up, such the head of the Maltese cross, the bottle head of the cross, is downwards. The Maltese cross will, which is sitting at, say, from zero, is sitting at 70 or 80 degrees, will sit down and lie flat at 180 degrees, flat out of the way. And then when the light comes across, the light will hit your shadow area of the Maltese Cross. Now, what will happen here is that this glass, which has been protected over the time, will fluoresce much more strongly. So you'll see a positive image of the Maltese Cross glowing positively brightly. Now, you're going to choose not to tell students all about this, and we'll discuss about it. But the one thing they will remember is they'll remember a bit of the shadow, but they will remember that electrons coming out of going through free space, when it hits glass, will produce a Maltese Cross whether it's there or not. And they do remember it, and you question people, and I don't know, again, you're going to... Now, at this stage, we're going to say that we've got basically a virtual electron gun. That is, a small device which produces electrons, and it fires the electrons from the surface of the electrodes forward. The important thing is that after it reaches a certain energy, these electrons have a different cross-section. So a high-energy electron can actually travel a fair distance through a gas, whereas a low-energy electron will tend to collide and bumble about the place. And there's a lot of quantum mechanics to do with this. The actual shape of the electron changes with its energy. And go figure, but you do the actual quantum physics, and you'll see this. So the high-energy electrons can actually have a lower cross-section going through. So you have this basically millimeter accelerator in front of your electrode, due to this virtual tube of glass. I asked you to look at it on the internet. I think you can actually see the phenomena by just looking through images, but if you have one of these in the lab, you'll see it. So these accelerates, and so these are in ballistic trajectories, in a cone of ballistic trajectories, and if you introduce a magnetic field, I call it the right-hand slap rule. So your fingers point in the direction from your north pole. Your thumb points in the direction of the current. Now, the current is an electron, so your thumb is pointing to your left. So you introduce the north pole, that will actually sweep the actual field down. So if you introduce your north pole from in front of you, to this, and the electrons are travelling from left to right, that will push the shadow downwards. And so the interesting thing is that you will see the shadow dance and move as you move your magnet. You know, that's an important thing to show, that the particles coming off from this are charged. Now, bear in mind that, to a fault, I have actually never, ever heard or listened to a teacher explain, and I myself haven't stuck my head out and done it. I've only just allowed people to make the correct observation that the electrons are not coming out as a uniform field left to right. They're coming out as a cone. But you can observe this and say, look, these must be charged. You're obviously not providing enough information for the students to understand this. Then similarly, you could provide a instantaneous electric field there and observe them move about the place. And this is something to discuss later on. Could you do this with an electric field rather than with a magnetic field? And we'll have to discuss magnetic fields a bit later on. Then there's the next level of device called Leonard, and I say that because I suppose Leonard, I don't have the English, I'm used to working with lots of Russians called Leonard, but so I call it Leonard. And he developed a device, basically a Crookes tube, a Maltese cross, but on the surface, the final surface of it, he replaced the glass with, aluminium must have been discovered by now, because replaced it with a very thin aluminium window. This is Coke can thinness, extremely thin of a certain area. And I suppose it would have been pumped out. So this window, it would have been bowed in due to pressure. It's a very thin window, and he could observe up to, I suppose, 2 millimetres, a centimetre long, short wave, short distance electrons would travel through this very thin metal foil. Now, a lot of people say, oh, look, they observe electrons travel the other side of the Maltese cross. No, this is not true. This is something a millionth thickness of a Maltese cross. And electrons hitting this will travel through, and they'll travel a short distance in air. And this is their definition of his belief that this can actually go through metal, given the fact that they're at this stage not so sure what atoms are or electrons are. They believe that this is similar to holding the metal up to light, and I would expect that the metal was so thin that light would actually be able to travel through it, or fairly similar. So if you have a metal foil which is this thin, you can actually see, sometimes can see light through it. So his belief was there, this pointed towards the fact that it was a wave. So you have your wave particle story, but a lot of people's support for waves built on an incorrect assumption at the time, which has been brought forward faithfully, preserved by schools ever since, that this negative electrode is producing a wave of electrons, which are all jumping off the surface. So it's a bit like they believed, if I hold a piece of paper, it's white all over from all angles, but there's an equal amount of light coming off the entire surface. And so they believe that this true is also true from the metal. There's an equal number of electrons coming off the entire surface. This is, in actual fact, not true. The electrons were coming off the areas of highest radius of curvature and basically being sucked off a flat surface from a virtual high radius of curvature of a artificial positive gas column which is coming in. So this may be a hard thing. I would assume people who don't know Maltese crosses won't listen to this, but I certainly do hope that teachers and scientists who have seen this demonstration and, I suppose, care about the potential of this demonstration to teach observation and to look at it. You may well be in a lucky country where everyone has seen this. Unfortunately, where I've been in Canada and Australia, I think a few other countries, this has not been described well. It's obviously not been described well in textbooks or on the internet. So this is a definitive description. If you feel a bit, angry that this is different from what you've heard or understood, can I just ask, go into the lab, have a look at one of these tubes, look at the electrodes, and before you even hook it up, think, why is there a dirty big burn mark in the very centre of this button electrode? Why is that there? And then switch it on, and then ask yourself, how is this cross magnified? Observe the eerie blue glow of this positive column coming down. Observe the positive column coming to a point more small above. So perhaps, having listened to this, your powers of observation will be there. You may have observed it already. I, unfortunately, am someone who just observes and thinks. There really is literally nothing going in my head. The actual connections are going without any sort of voice going in my head. I think I'm lucky. I hear something, and that description goes to one part of my head, but when I go and observe, it's in another part, and perhaps that's what we want to build up here. So your Crookes tube, your Crook's Tube or Maltese Cross by Plucker, and the effect seen by Hitoff are all very, very rich and very worth the discussion, and very hard to describe in terms of bringing that description forward in a world before the electron was conclusively discovered by J.J. Thompson. So this is very much my discussion of the Maltese Cross, and this is part of my, I suppose, cardiac rehab, being able to produce a fairly high rate and quality of fairly in-depth podcasts. And I am aware that these are not popular podcasts. These are podcasts for teachers and I suppose scientists really looking into it. But that's what I'm really aiming for. And over the time, I'll be able to morph from a more detailed description, scientific descriptions, into more popular. So I'm going to go from the scientific towards the popular rather than kid myself and go from popular to the scientific. Thanks for listening, and in the meantime, keep on doing science and plug things up and see what you can observe. There's lots of great things to observe in humble school science experiments. Bye for now. Thanks for listening.